Before we begin, the Differently Brained team acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we record, edit, and stream this podcast. We pay our respects to all First Nations peoples and their elders, past, present, and emerging. We extend that respect to all First Nations cultures and their ongoing connection to the lands, waterways, and communities. Now on with the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the podcast that you've all come to know as Differently Brained, because that's what it's called. I'm Lachlan Rutherford.
And I'm Jacinta Dietrich. And again, we have a wonderful guest. I was laughing because I was trying to think of something different like Lachlan does, but I couldn't. But we're here with Brittany St. John. Brittany is an occupational therapist and researcher with a focus on autistic eating. Most of her work is focused on supporting autistic children and their families in navigating selective diets and supporting sensory preferences and needs. Her most recent research collaborations are exploring sensory and nutritional modifications to foods to increase the acceptability of foods that may support health. Brittany, welcome.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
We're stoked to have you. To kick us off, I would love to know, how did you get into occupational therapy and research? Did one come before the other, or is it a two-pronged interest that you've always had?
Oh, one definitely came before the other. I started actually on my career journey headed towards psych, and then quickly realized that wasn't quite what I wanted. I wanted something more playful and interactive, and I wanted more variety, and OT is just that. So I always knew I wanted to work with kids. But I just loved the playfulness of being an OT. And then about halfway through OT school, I just fell for research. I was involved in the development of a feeding assessment for autistic children. So it's a questionnaire that we give to families to learn more about their feeding challenges and to help treatment plan. And I ran that research for my thesis, and the rest is history. So 9 years later, here we are.
Great. And is that essentially how you ended up in this particular niche of research in autism?
Yeah, kind of. So the lab I was placed in, I had like almost no choice in OT school, was my PhD advisor after a few years, but her focus was on feeding and autism. And so we did some evaluations of family meal times and looked at some of the strategies that families are using. We developed that questionnaire, but diving into that from a research perspective really allowed me to understand the impact of selective eating and how it can really change family life, and how OTs spend a lot of time thinking about family life and routine. And so it was this beautiful match of my therapeutic interests and then also my drive to be more research-brained. I've always loved numbers and Excel and data, and so it was a logical progression for me, but somewhat unexpected.
Right.
For our listeners that might not know or have heard the term, can you explain what selective eating is? I know definitely when I started to look into this area, I hadn't ever thought of myself as a selective eater or anything like that. You know, and I had all of those other fun labels that you get put on you, but I've only started to really look at it since looking at your research and things like that. Can you explain selective eating in a nutshell kind of thing? I know there's a lot more complexity to it than what you'll probably be able to go into.
I will try. So the way I think about selective eating is anybody who is restricting their diet or having some challenges eating specific things because of their own, typically it's your sensory profile, but it might also be your drive for sameness, your like need for consistency. So when those internal factors are driving food choices to the level that your diet is limited. Mm-hmm. So we all make choices about food based on our sensory preferences and flavor preferences and need for variety or consistency. But for many people, those choices don't limit the number of foods you eat. You still eat a really wide variety from all the different food groups. But for selective eaters, they're typically getting down to really restricted range. And then that that can be stressful for families and for kids and for adolescents and adults that are starting to navigate their own diet. It can have long-term impacts on your gut health and your growth and development. It can really just have these cascading effects. And so it begins to be, selective eating is sort of the tipping point for when you need to think about solving the problem. But there isn't a diagnostic classification for selective eating. In all of my studies, it's either self-defined or defined by a parent. And it's really about what is happening because of the selection in your diet.
No, I just wanted to know, like, actually, it's a question for you, Jacinta. Do you have a selective eating criterion aside from, I guess, you know, your dietary stuff?
I didn't think I did until I started looking into. So I really love being on the other side of the research. I love going in and doing the, you know, being the test subject, I guess, for want of a better word, the answerer, the participant. Mm-hmm. I just think it's really, really fun. And I think it's an awesome thing that I get to do with my brain and my traits and things like that. So I didn't think I did until I got this email from Brittany. Maybe I followed it up. I don't know. I found out about Brittany's current stuff and I went back to my family and I was like, guys, am I like a selective eater? And compared to my sister, compared to Tay, I really didn't think I was, because she's very selective about what she will and won't eat, specifically around texture and what it looks like and meat and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so in comparison, I was like, nah, I eat everything. And then we started talking about it and we realized that, in fact, I don't eat everything. So whereas Tay's is very much looking at it and the visual, so she won't eat, you know, the red parts in chicken and she won't eat the fatty parts in red meat and she won't eat, you know, all these different parts of things, even though she'll still eat parts of that meal. Mine is textural, so I won't eat multigrain bread because it's got bits in it and that's disgusting. I won't eat choc chip ice cream because it's got bits in it. So yeah, no, I did, as I started to decide, kind of look into whether I was actually suitable for some of these research studies and things, I realized that, yeah, there is a lot of selective eating behaviors that I do participate in. We found out the other day that one of them is, I guess, similar to Tay's, where I need to see what I'm eating. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily that I won't eat that thing if I can see it, but just the knowledge of what's going into my mouth at one time. So I will always, always, always eat with the big light on. I'm a big light person. And my mum isn't. And so, you know, she came in the other day and we're eating dinner and she was like, can we turn the big light off? And I was like, no, because I'm still eating. And then we started to get into, oh, why do I need the big light to eat? And it's because I will still eat everything that's in my bowl, but I need to know what's coming into my mouth and what it looks like and what texture to expect, whether I'm, you know, eating a carrot or a capsicum or a chicken or whatever it was in the stir fry. It doesn't matter. And it's all safe food in that bowl, but I need to know what's coming.
Yeah.
So no, yeah, it was something that I definitely hadn't really thought about or realized until all of this. And now it's been a fun, like, oh, yay, okay, which has been helpful of, you know, finding alternatives of textures. I'm always a crispy, crunchy, chip-based kind of textural gal. So it's been really fun learning this about myself.
Yeah, well, and I think what's cool about what you were just talking about between you and your sister is that selective eating looks different for each individual.
Yeah.
And it's really reflective of your individual sensory preferences, the foods you were exposed to culturally or within your family. You know, there's just so many variables that come into it. And so it's a very complex thing to define and also a very complex thing to create intervention for because of that.
Yeah. I think there's so much stereotype around it as well. You know, the representations that you see are the person who doesn't want their foods to touch and things like that. And it has been very oversimplified. Whereas, like you said, selective eating looks so different for everyone, especially, you know, when you break it down into the different sensory components and even within families, it's such a unique thing. I also think that there's like a lot of hesitancy for autistic and neurodivergent people around research, given the history of autism research and, you know, the specific groups that it is focused on. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's still gaps in this research space and what are they?
Oh, I definitely, first I want to acknowledge that that hesitancy is valid. And I definitely do believe that there are still gaps in this research space, specifically around our understanding of how people come to form their selective diets and what interventions are they interested in, are possible, would be enjoyable, accepted, positive. I also think we really have a very surface level understanding of the interaction between sensory profiles or subtypes and selective diets and how that might have an impact on health or quality of life. And so there's some serious questions that need to be interrogated in that area for us to better serve the diversity of selective eaters.
And so, like, how are you making sure that your research is inclusive of autistic and neurodivergent people? I mean, are there people in your study team that are neurodiverse or certain practices that you're doing that kind of accommodate for certain people?
Yeah, so that's one of my primary research values, is that the work that I do is really community-based and community-informed and participatory. So participatory is a research term that really means the community or population you're studying is engaged in the research with you as a shared partner.
Right.
That value for me goes all the way back to my PhD work and some of my early research experiences, partnering with the intellectual disability community and really working on bringing them in as research partners. And then as I moved into this autism space a little bit, it really expanded there too. So to answer some of the specifics you just said, yes, there are neurodivergent people on my team. I work within an incredible research center, the Olga Tennison Autism Research Center right now, where a huge percentage of the researchers here have neurodivergent traits or are diagnosed autistic or ADHD, which is a huge benefit to the work that we do. I also come from a neurodiverse family, which I think really informs my approach to research that includes families. And then the work that we do starts with community perception work. So we really start with focus groups and bringing in people who are representative of the community to tell us what they think about the idea and to really drive the research forward. And we lean heavily on advisory groups or panels to help us make sure that our research is aligned with community needs.
Cool. I think that sort of collaboration first approach to research is oftentimes like super lacking in scientific and medical areas. So it's great and also necessary that, that your team is doing that in this field.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people think of it as really complicated, which it can be really complicated or really expensive, but it's so valuable. And there's really documented effects on research outcomes for the inclusion that it is well worth the investment and the time.
Yeah.
And so we're working really hard to advocate for that.
How do you get the community involved? Like, I don't remember at all, apparently, how I became a participant in your current stuff, but how do you spread the word if people are interested in, you know, learning more about you and studies like research like this?
Yeah, so the recruitment that I am leaning on most is the channels of OTARC, you know, the research center. And so they spread the word through their email listserv and their Facebook and their LinkedIn. And they have this beautiful longstanding connection to the autism community in Melbourne. And that allows them to bring a wide variety of participants and community members in. The specific actions that we're taking in my ongoing research is really from a focus group informative approach. So we're bringing in people to focus groups, learning from them. And then anyone who participates in the focus groups right now is invited to continue in the study. And every stage of the study informs the next stage of the study. And then also autistic researchers here help guide the work based on their, you know, lived experience connection to the autism community.
I love that. And I love that, you know, being a participant at the moment, I love being able to watch as it develops and see it from, you know, what feels like early stages to watch how you guys are doing it as well. I feel like I'm learning a lot from this side of it, of how research happens and how it can work with community inclusivity and things like that. It's been really, really fun to watch each stage build on the one before it, and just I get so excited.
Well, I love to hear that too, because I really believe that we're approaching it with a best effort to be inclusive. But until the community validates that we're doing that right, you just don't know, right? Yeah. And so we really need the loop to get closed. We need to hear from the participants and the advisors that, like, yes, you're on the right track. Yes, we feel validated. Yes, this represents our experiences, because otherwise we're just going in blind.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. I swan in and tell you guys what I think and swan out. And then next time I see you, you guys have actioned everything. And it's just insane that, like, it's, I think, something that still feels really rare, which is unfortunate that, you know, I come in and give opinions that for so long I haven't thought were valid or warranted or important or anything. And that, you know, each time it happens and then I come back for the next focus group or something to see those taken into account and actioned and worked on, it just is so, so validating just as a neurodivergent person, as an autistic person, that not only are you giving me the opportunity to share my experiences, but you're actively using it. It makes me feel special.
So glad. I also think there's, like Lachlan, you said it is rare and it's something that still needs to keep moving forward. But what's really fantastic is that we're starting to see funders who have all the power in research, right? We're starting to see them move towards requiring community participation.
Okay.
And I think that that is going to make a huge difference in the next 5 to 10 years for what research looks like and who's engaged and what research is elevated and funded. And if you have a solid community participatory model, then you're much more likely to be successful, which is really, that is very different from the history of research.
Absolutely.
You mentioned it before, but can you tell us a little bit more? What is OTARC?
Yeah. Okay. So I probably won't do it its full justice. because I am here as a visiting research fellow, as I'm sure you've picked up, I have an American accent. And I am here just for a year and a half on my postdoc. But OTARC is a research center that is established at La Trobe University. And it came about because of this fantastic woman, Olga Tennyson, who really cared deeply about autistic people and also had a lot of money. And so she started funding research here and supporting the work here. And it has just grown and grown and grown. And so her gift allowed for the research center to be developed. And now it is a thriving network of researchers who are all focused on autism through different lenses. So we have some early identification people. We have some people who are in the childcare space thinking about intervention in the early childcare years. We have mental health focused people, suicide prevention focused people, sleep focused people. I do feeding, co-occurring conditions like ADHD and anxiety. Oh my gosh, that is not even close to the whole list. and the entire focus is to support autistic thriving. It's that we want to support autistic people to live full and wonderful lives and reduce the challenges that are present, be that through like awareness or services or interventions or whatever. But yeah, it's fantastic.
It sounds fantastic, yeah.
And the spaces themselves are awesome. You know, when I went in, there's squishmallows in the room, which was excellent. I thought the other participants had brought them, and then I realized they were everywhere, and I was like, oh my God, yes. And they're just super comfy and lovely. But we'll pop more in the show notes for people who want to learn more about all of that, because it is, yeah, a really, really wonderful research center. Lachlan, should we go to a break?
I think we should go to a break.
Should we get a break? Let's get a break.
Let's get a break.
That could be our throw to the break. What do you think?
That's a good throw to the break. Yes. Right. Let's keep that. Welcome back from your break, from the break, everyone. I hope that you did whatever you wanted to do during that time. And now you're back to talk about stuff with us. We're talking to Brittany St. John today. And Brittany, can you tell us a little bit more about your most recent research?
Or any research, if you're not allowed to talk about your most recent stuff.
So I am not allowed to talk about my most recent research, which is currently happening, I guess. It's not even like recent, it's ongoing. So I can't really disclose that a bunch, but I can give you some general themes. So most of my work, as we've established, is around autistic diets or autistic feeding, and I work with young children. Since coming to OTARC, I have really expanded into some unique and interesting spaces. We've had some wonderful partnerships open up with some food innovation partners here and some nutrition and dietetics researchers here. And, we have hatched a few ideas. So the focus of our work right now is thinking about the sensory underpinnings of feeding challenges. So that, like I talked about before, that gap in we understand that sensory is driving food choice, but we don't really understand why or how. And we also know that there's these distinctive subtypes in sensory presentations, and those have really been ignored when thinking about feeding. So feeding has always been like, yeah, it's associated with sensory, but the specifics aren't there. And so we're trying to dig into the specifics. We're starting with a lived experience qualitative work, and we're moving towards some more large-scale characterization work.
Right.
Within all of that, we have learned that sensory modification of foods is available. It's something that can happen. And so we've started partnering with food innovators to think about what modifications would be helpful to make foods more palatable for a large percentage of autistic people, if that's even possible? And then is there a way we could make foods more nutritious to address some of those gut health issues or those gaps in diets due to selective eating, and then also have them be sensory enjoyable? And so we're working on some food development routes at this point in time. I can't be super specific about that. Mm-hmm. but it's exciting and different, very different from any work I've ever done. And then the rest of my work, the work that brought me here, is piloting a family engaged intervention with children ages 2 to 7. And I'm wrapping that work up. So I've been running a parent mediated feeding intervention where I really partner with parents to think about changes that can be made in their home and foods that can be offered that match their child's unique sensory needs and preferences, and then also support their health and development. And that has been a really fulfilling piece of my research because it brings my clinical skills and my research brain together in one place. Mm-hmm.
You've been insanely busy. Oh my gosh.
I have been insanely busy. Yes, that's 100% true. Yeah, but in like the most exciting ways. And my next step, so I actually leave Australia in May. My next step is to move to the University of Washington in Seattle as a faculty member and researcher there. And so a lot of this work is the foundation for my research career in Washington, and hopefully will lead to really exciting things there.
That's amazing. Congratulations. But that's so soon.
It's so soon. Yeah. Don't worry. All the work that is ongoing here is very much going to continue. I will just be doing it virtually.
That was my next question. How does the ongoing research that you're involved in at the moment, how does that keep going without you?
It won't keep going without me. It will keep going with me virtually involved and some other people
in the work. Cool.
Here. Yeah. So it's a really exciting train to be like along for the ride with. And I am doing a lot of the project management right now, but that's really not necessary. There's a lot of other amazing researchers on the team. And so the torch will be passed and I will still be involved and get to learn about all the findings and contribute to the next stage, but from a distance.
Wow. Right. That is bonkers. That's so much. How exciting.
Yeah, it's really cool.
It might seem obvious, and you touched on it a little bit, but I would love to dig around in it a little bit more. Why might sensory and nutritional modifications be important for food specifically, whether it's for, you know, autistic people or whether it's just generally?
Yeah. Well, I think it really comes back to this idea of what is a selective diet first. So let's just back up a little bit. That when we're talking about making these modifications, we're thinking about people who are so selective that their dietary quality is poor. And so they're completely missing fruits. They're completely missing vegetables. They might be down to like 10 foods. And so then we're really looking for key ways that we can boost their nutrition without pushing their sensory world into chaos. So previously, interventions have really focused on increasing the tolerance of that person, right?
Yeah.
If I just expose you to enough broccoli, you will eventually learn to love broccoli. And the reality is that for some people, that works a little bit. You can eventually learn to tolerate some foods. And I think learning to expose to foods, you can find foods you enjoy. But if you really truly hate broccoli, if your sensory system rejects broccoli, I can never expose you to enough broccoli to get you to eat it.
Yeah.
And so this approach is sort of a workaround where we're saying, okay, what's a food that you do eat? What's something that you do like? And can we make it more nutritious? Or what's a food that you kind of like, or you could handle, but could we make it more enjoyable? Could we make it crunchier? Could we make it, more consistent? Like every time you eat it, it tastes exactly the same. And so you're not worried about the predictability of that snack. And that has been a really exciting pathway to head down because it's allowing us to think about intervention from full acceptance of your sensory profile and your preferences. And like, let's try to get you nutrition in a different way without trying to change your core self, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that. I have been hooked on the Nutri-V chippies that I found through you guys, actually. Those little, I don't know if they count as chippies, those vegetable puff things, which are essentially broccoli and cauliflower and things like that. They've also got a pumpkin one that I haven't tried. Put into a crunchy, delicious snack that, you know, there's a whole cup of broccoli in one serve of those. And one serve is like half the packet, which is awesome because it means there's heaps of it. It's healthy and it tastes really good.
Yeah.
So I've become absolutely open to the world of sensory food modifications and I am here for it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is just the reason we're doing what we're doing right there is that the community has resoundingly said, yes, please give me food that is consistent and matches my sensory preferences and brings me nutrition. And so we are trying to respond with, okay, let's see what we can do.
Yeah.
And it's been a really exciting thing to completely shift our approach. And luckily, we have all the people here who know how to do that. So.
And I think it just feels so, again, you're affirming that instead of going down the, you know, exposure therapy route where it's just like, eventually you will give in and you will like this. Like, no, we will not. The fact that it's, you know, meeting us where we are is just so validating and so nice and so much easier for all of us, to be honest. Like, I imagine that the person who has to do the, here, eat this broccoli 50 times and eventually, like, you know, the professional on the other side of that isn't going to have fun either. Like, nobody in that scenario wins. No one in that scenario is having fun unless, I guess, you're a sadistic broccoli-loving weirdo who loves making other people sad or something. But, like, this sounds just so much more fun and sciencey and affirming and enjoyable for everybody involved.
Yeah, and I do want to plug that it's probably not a solution for everybody.
Yeah.
But that's also kind of the name of the game, right?
Yes.
Like we need to understand that the match for the individual to the intervention is the most crucial match. And so finding what works for that person is essential. And for some people, sensory modified foods will be the key. And for some people, a family engaged intervention that helps parents understand their child's neurology and food choice will be the key. And you have to match the need to the intervention. And
that's
a huge thing.
You're right. It's the name of the game. And in regards to what we just mentioned before about exposure therapy as the be all and end all of all kinds of therapy, like if that isn't going to work with certain amounts of people, then it will also follow that the one-size-fits-all approach of modifying food in a particular way also isn't going to work for everyone. Mm-hmm. So I think, like, having that in mind, as you guys do, is so great and actually, like, properly scientific.
Yeah. I also think it's really cool to come at intervention from a perspective of affirm and do no harm.
Yeah.
And I think that intervention has not come from that perspective for a long time. And so being a clinician that can step in and say, no, 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 your sensory system is your sensory system. Your brain is your brain, but your food choice might be impacting your health. So what can we do to help you, you know, repair your health?
Yeah.
And that it's just a very different perspective, but it is really wonderful as a clinician to be able to work with people where they're like, yes, thank you. that's so refreshing.
Yeah. For people who, after listening to this episode, who might be interested in this area of research or interested even in participating as subjects in this area of research, what could they do as individuals? How could they get into it?
Yeah, so there's a really easy way. first of all, you can just follow OTARC. So in whatever platform you use, I believe they tweet, although I'm not a tweet person. Mm-hmm. But Facebook, I think they have a LinkedIn. And then they also just for us old school people, they have just an email listserv. So you can sign up for their email list. And as opportunities come up, you will receive an email. They also run a blog where all the currently recruiting studies are listed on that blog. And if you're curious about any of the studies I'm running, or you think you might be a good participant for any of the studies that are going on right now that I'm involved in related to feeding, all the available ones are listed on that blog and you can send me an email and I can get you signed up. But yeah, really just OTARC is like the starting point for research recruitment. And I would really encourage everyone to be on their listserv. They also share wonderful other things. It's not just research, right? There's the director's blog about what's going on. They'll share community events. They do a lot of public-facing things where you can come and listen to people present their research or give feedback on their research. They bring in different speakers occasionally. They do a seminar series monthly. There's just like a lot of resources there.
That's amazing. And for listeners who maybe want to jump on the other side, how would you suggest people go about if they wanted to get into research like yourself and be on the researcher side of things? How do people do that?
I think it depends on where you're starting from.
Yeah.
So one traditional path, if you're kind of like a PhD focused person, if you're headed towards higher ed, there are autistic specific scholarships available through OTARC for PhD students. So
that's cool.
If you are thinking about getting a PhD and you're an autistic researcher, this is a really wonderful place to be supported. And I would encourage you to reach out and see if there's a supervisor here that could be a good match for you. If you are not a higher ed focused person, you don't have the time for it, you would rather come at it from your lived experience only, which is extremely valuable, then I would also encourage you to reach out to anyone you see on the OTARC website that seems like they're matching your interests. So like if it's feeding me, if it's anxiety or mental health, there's a lot of other people here, variety of interests, and see if they're looking for someone on their team, because it's actually really, really hard to find people who want to provide that lived expertise on our research team consistently. And so if you know you're interested, please, please, please find a researcher, because I know they would love to have you. If it is a big hurdle to identify the match for the researcher, then I would encourage you to just email the general information line at OTARC and they will direct you to the right person. So we have a research coordinator who runs our advisory board. There's, you know, lots of ways to get involved there. We have a participant bank, or I forget what it's called, registry, I think, where you can sign up to just be listed as a participant on regular studies. So lots of opportunities, and that main email that will get you routed to the right person.
That's wonderful. Also helpful. Thank you.
Yeah.
There's just so many avenues into it that I hadn't even considered. In my mind, it was just the PhD way. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, but there's so many others. That's awesome.
And actually, I would really encourage people who are on the fence to test out partnering with a researcher as a lived expertise research team member, because it is so valuable on our end. We get so much from it. But it also gives you a sense of what research life is like.
Yeah.
And if you don't like it, you can quit at any point. Like, You can just kind of be done anytime you want. But I would encourage you to give it a try because it is so valuable to research and you have so much power from your lived expertise. And I think we need to really elevate that.
That's brilliant. Yeah, you kind of get the best of both worlds. So if you get to trial it out, you get to see what happens. And like you said, you can also just leave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you sure can.
We have one final question for you, which I'm not sure if there is an answer for it. I couldn't think of any when I thought about it, but you're the expert. Maybe you'll know. Mm-hmm. What are the best representations of selective eating that you've seen across any media, so books, film, music, whatever? If you don't have any representations, resources is also brilliant.
Oh my goodness. So I actually... I won't be able to call usernames from memory, but I follow a number of people on TikTok who are, or Instagram too, who are lovely representations of life with selective eating, and their own personal solutions and experiences with that process. I'd be happy to email you.
That's fantastic. Yes, please do.
Yeah. But I can't think of anything in like shows or movies.
No, neither could I.
I'm also not a big media consumer, so that might be a problem. But yeah, I'll have a think on it. If I can come up with something you can add to the show notes, I definitely
will share that.
That's amazing. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so, so much for coming on and speaking to us today. It's such a blast always just learning about different aspects of things that I have no idea about, and research is definitely one of them. We'll absolutely share all of those things in the show notes, and we'll miss you when you head off to Washington.
I will not be far, so please keep your eye on work here that I will be involved in, I'm sure. And then anyone who wants to follow my work, the one place I am very visible is LinkedIn and ResearchGate. So I guess it's two places, but yeah, you're welcome to find me there.
Amazing. We'll pop those in the show notes as well. But thank you so much for coming on today.
Yeah, thank you.
If you guys want to follow our stuff in all the usual avenues, I will tell you them again. We have a Facebook group, which is a pretty cool place. And you can go there and we can have a chat. You can do the questionnaire if you'd like to become a guest on Differently Brained. We've also got an Instagram where I post just some deranged rubbish sometimes and just need to post some actually useful stuff. And just generally support us by giving us a like, leaving a comment. We're on basically every podcast service. So yeah, thanks for coming along and goodbye.
Bye. Bye.
Differently Brained shares the opinions of individuals and does not consider your personal circumstances. Differently Brained exists purely for information purposes and should not be relied on as health or medical advice. Because no brain is the same, please consult your healthcare professional for your personal medical needs.